There is a real Farmer Brown. We run Mustard Seed Farms, which is in St. Paul, Oregon, the home of the number one 4th of July rodeo. And we farm here on about 65 acres, raising organic veggies.
Dave, how long have you been farming?
Approximately 40 years. I guess I started raising vegetables for wholesale in 1967.
Was that here in St. Paul?
That was. We started here in St. Paul, a farm that my dad had purchased while we were in college. And after two or three years of helping him with his grain operation, we took over an 8-acre piece and started raising vegetables.
Your father wasn't a farmer when you were a little kid.
Yes, he was. I grew up on a 160-acre dryland farm in California, just north of Sacramento. And we just raised wheat primarily. And we had some livestock. I grew up raising goats. That's my favorite animal. And so we had a farm background, and that farm got sold for subdivision as the area grew, and my dad still wanted to farm. So the land was cheaper, and the wheat yields were so much better up here, so he drove 600 miles and hauled all the equipment up here and bought a 150-acre farm.
That farm surely was very different from what you have now and the way things are done now. You're an organic farmer and certified. Just generally, how have things changed in farming, at least your way of farming, in your life of doing it?
Well, I've often thought that I probably practiced the 4-H model that I was in for 5 years as a kid, and that's learning by doing. And my major in college at George Fox was psychology, sociology. I've always said I have a psych-soc degree, and I've been out playing in the dirt for 40 years. So I watched my neighbors and picked up here and there and grew whatever I thought I could grow to make money. I mean, on that 8 acres, I had 4 acres of that was pickling cucumbers for Libby McNeil. And then in ensuing years, when I took over the whole farm, I had up to 25 acres of pickling cucumbers. So I had cannery crops as well as some fresh market crops, and we did U-picks. And so we had people coming to the farm, and we got into berries and had strawberries and some black caps and cannery corn. And so that's kind of where we were. Then eventually, as we moved to Newburgh, and our lifestyles were gradually changing to a more natural lifestyle. We felt that we could farm better, and I met a gal who was selling fish fertilizer. And so when the opportunity came that we thought that we ought to get certified organic, then that was an easy transition, went through our 3 years and got certified. And then it's been a gradual thing to kind of plan the market. Any kind of business, you need to know what your market is. And I think that historically everybody says that's one of farmers' problems. Everybody likes to go out and farm and raise a crop. But if you don't have a market, then that's kind of tough. And after we got certified, we had as little as 6 acres of certified land to farm on. And eventually got up to 30 acres in there, and now we're up to 65. And that increase in acreage has come about as the markets have developed, primarily with our major wholesaler. And as you develop a relationship with a customer, they like what you grow. And if your customers like what it is, you can increase the acreage. So that's how we've developed our farm, just little by little, not overnight, over the years.
So, okay, demand has changed for different things. So you mentioned pickles for Libby's. They don't have a plant here anymore, right?
That is correct. Libby's had their plant in Portland near Cleveland High School. Their plant was there. Then they had it in Salem. They had a receiving station over here at Woodburn at that time. And then we switched over to Nally's when Libby's got out of the business, and they hauled up to Tacoma, and we hauled them to Salem to a receiving station there. So, well, nowadays we grow maybe a 100 or 200 foot row of pickling cucumbers, and that's about all the market we have.
So a lot of different crops over the years. Other examples of ones that you've stopped growing, and also others that you maybe you were pleasantly surprised you started small because you thought you might get somewhere with it and it turned out, or if you, maybe a crop failure, maybe you didn't grow it right, or the soil wasn't right, or the weather was a disaster or something.
Well, Bruce, I have several answers to that question.
I knew you would.
One of the major crops that we've grown for quite a few years is leaf lettuce. And when I was still conventional, I was selling some squash to Fred Meyer, and I was talking to Dario Cusciato, if people remember him promoting produce for Fred Meyer for a number of years as their produce buyer, and I talked to him about lettuce, and he says, Dave, don't grow lettuce. It's so easy. Everybody grows lettuce. Well, I persisted, and I suppose maybe when I became organic, I could see there was a market for it. And so I, yes, it's easy to grow, but it's a good crop and good money in it. So I persisted with that, and eventually Jeff Fairchild, who's with New Seasons now, the old Nature Stores, bought directly from me and helped me get going with lettuce. And then we've grown it for OGC, Organically Grown Company, in Eugene, who's the major wholesaler in the Northwest. With their encouragement, I've gradually increased the acreage of leaf lettuce, and we still grow it. Another crop that we're growing a lot of now, as I say, cole crops, are the brassicas, cabbages, and broccoli, and cauliflower. I tried to grow that early on and was getting eaten out of house and home with aphids and one thing and another, and so I just kind of backed off from that. But then little by little, I started working on insect control, and now probably, I used to be overbalanced with squashes and pumpkins, and now I'm overbalanced with cauliflower, cabbage, and broccoli as far as crop rotations in the field. So that's developed into a major crop for us. In fact, here, starting in March, we will probably start harvesting, I don't know, it's between 4 and 5 acres of overwintering cauliflower that we planted last August. And we'll be selling several hundred cases of cauliflower a week here in the spring. And that's a crop that we have done for a number of years, maybe 10 years or more. And I've talked to two or three other growers, just said it hasn't worked for them. But for us, most of the time it has worked.
So with cauliflower and broccoli, if I see fresh, organic cauliflower and broccoli in a local store, especially mid to late winter, it's probably yours, right?
Probably a 50-50 chance that it could be, because OGC sells all over the whole Northwest. Look for the label on it. You'll see a white label on it, and it'll say Mustard Seed Farms and cauliflower. So if you see that on, if it's some foreign California one, obviously, you know, it's not me.
Can you share any of your debugging secrets?
Well, you can do what most people think organic growers do not do, and that is spray. Spraying is not bad. It's what you spray. And pyrethrin, Pyganic is a brand, but pyrethrin is what we've used for years. We used to have a pyrethrin-rotenone combination, which was even better. And now, working with a small farm specialist here at the experiment station, the last couple of years, we've come up with another product, which I can't tell you, remember the name, but it has rosemary and mint oil in it. And I think maybe it even works better. But the key that we're... with he and I working together, that we've found is you've got to spray early. Once you get a plant that's half grown, all those leaves are on there, you can't get down in there where the aphids are. And it's been amazing to me. I've often waited till the plant's maybe, you know, got 6 or 8 or 10 leaves on it, and you're looking around and, oh, maybe you might start seeing an aphid. But if you go out there 10 days after you transplant it and open up those tiny little leaves in the center, 9 times out of 10, you're going to find one aphid sitting down in there. And so you need to start spraying every 7 to 10 days at that time and keep the aphid population down when the plant is small. And then when it's half grown, you've got the battle won.
And that reminds me, what you're spraying, we have in this country the National Organic Program, which is a very comprehensive and detailed law that was passed, I guess, about 10 years ago. Is it a hassle for you to have to consult the book, so to speak, every time you want to do something on your farm?
Well, when it first came in, that was an issue that Oregon Tilth kind of put the onus back on us, that we had to check out all the ingredients on stuff. But fortunately, we have two agencies that certify products that meet NOP, and one is Washington State Department of Agriculture checks products, and so you can see a WSDA on there, and the other one is an OMRI prove, which is Organic Material Review Institute, headquartered right here in Eugene, Oregon. So here in the Northwest, we have the two certifiers that approve products. And so now it's pretty well accepted. If either one of those or both approve a product, then we can use it. And most of the time, it says it in the literature and or on the label of the product.
Besides pests, there are other reasons why crops may or may not do well. The soil and the climate, I don't know if we've stated it clearly, but you had a farm a few miles from here that you were renting, and now you've moved to this one a few years ago. And different soil, different land mass. And I remember at the old place, you were right next to a large hill, and when I was buying corn from you, depending on where you had it that year, it might be as much as 3 weeks difference in the corn maturing, just because of microclimate next to the hill and where the freezing fog settled late in an October evening. Here, I remember when you first came here, you had an area that had just been logged before you. We won't blame you for clear cutting, but the land was available to you, and the soil there was something you hadn't worked with before. And it's a constant learning process, isn't it, about the soil and the pests in a particular location and the groundwater level and so on?
Yes, in Newburgh. Anybody familiar with Newburgh, where the Providence Hospital is now? That's where we used to farm. And we were there for 24 years. And so some of the ground had been put into nursery products and taken out, and others, we were just farming it most of the time and gradually built the soil up. We'd been there for a little over 10 years by the time we got certified organic. And so we had the ground in pretty decent shape. So it was a real learning experience when we moved over here. You're right, that 8-acre field that had been logged was in beautiful shape, and we were able to certify that right away because it had never been farmed and hadn't had any application of any prohibited materials. And that's probably still one of the best pieces of ground on the area that we farm. But the rest of it came out of grass seed, and we had areas where stuff didn't even grow sometimes, and so we had worked with it. We had a good source of chicken manure over here that comes from Woodburn, and so we've been applying chicken manure every year up until last year. And now with soil tests, we've realized that we have an abundance of nutrients in the soil. Our nitrate levels are way above what they need to be. And so this last year, we started backing off, and we only put chicken manure on where these overwintering and winter crops were. And we still use a dry pelletized chicken manure product too that we can apply on in small amounts in some other areas. All of our winter squash this last year, probably the best squash we've ever had, the largest size of squash, and the plants were big and everything else, not one drop of fertilizer on it. I mean, in that area, the nutrient levels were 3 to 4 times what that you need for to grow most vegetable crops. And even our onions this year, we've had trouble. We've had to sort out too big of onions for our wholesalers. And they were late in maturity. And I'm realizing that too much nutrients also can delay maturity and not only grow a big crop, but it gets too late. So it's been a real learning experience in six years now or seven, whatever it's been. But little by little, you know, you can get the ground into shape. And so you just have to kind of work with what you've got when you start with.
For those listeners who know their Oregon geography, we're on a plain called French Prairie in the Willamette River Valley, which before European people came here, it was good land then.
Yeah, it was the French Prairie when the French settlers came here and started the town of Shampooig, which we're just 2 miles south of that site. So if you come to Shampooig State Park and come over to French Prairie Road and come 2 miles south, you'd find our farm there, right?
Dave, changing the topic a little, you sell your crops in different ways to different types of people. You sell to wholesalers. We've already talked about that. I think you sell directly to some retailers. You sell directly to some individuals. You've had a community-supported agriculture operation in the past, but not now, and maybe other ways. Can you talk about these different ways and why you don't just sell your everything to one wholesaler like some huge farms do?
I think even huge farms probably have more than one wholesaler, but maybe not. They may have contracted acreage with them. But for us, it's worked. Even when I was conventional, I think you not only have to decide what crops you can grow and what you can do well, but also I've kind of analyzed, maybe it's personality or how you want to operate that determines maybe how you want to sell. I mean, I'm a people person, so going to a farmer's market would probably be an enjoyable experience for me. And we've enjoyed, we have a unique situation with a community garden where people come and work on our farm in exchange for food. I mean, they don't rent plots. They come and do whatever work needs to be on the farm, and they can come and get all the produce they need for their family. And so we're kind of unique there. So I enjoy working with people. But it just seems like I've always been more set up psychologically or whatever to work with wholesale. I mean, I can ship several pallets of merchandise out here on OGC's truck in a day and probably make more money on that, even though I'm getting less per unit, than going and sitting in the farmer's market all day and spending half a Friday getting ready for it and all day Saturday to sell it. So that's just kind of where I have sold to other farmers that have sold at farmer's markets, and so we've had a presence that way. And the same farmer started delivering to the co-ops in Portland, and then when he went out of business, we took over that. So we do deliver to the co-ops, the Food Fronts in Alberta and Peoples, and another home delivery service in Portland. And so people see our products in that way. And then we do have another wholesaler, Charlie's, we sell to also. And then we also still sell one item to Fred Meyer, and that's giant pumpkins. We are the giant pumpkin capital of the Northwest and sell over 1,000 giant pumpkins a year.
How did you get into that? And, you know, now that Fred Meyer, they're a huge corporation, part of an even bigger corporation, Kroger's, but at a certain time of year, we can come out into your fields and there's a Fred Meyer trailer truck getting loaded up. How did this happen?
That's a good question. Well, like I say, I did have a relationship with them when I was conventional and sold them primarily acorn squash and maybe a few other things. But we started growing giant pumpkins. I think I put in 5 plants one year and I got a 99-pound pumpkin. I thought, hooray, look what I've got, you know. But since then, we started learning how to do it. And, well, actually, we started with Fred Meyer, I think, was one of the first customers on that. And some other growers were selling to them, but they weren't doing as good a job as we were. And we have special little things we do for our pumpkins to make them look beautiful, and we put tags on them. And so I think we sold 70 pumpkins to Fred Meyer 15 or 16 years ago, and now we're selling them 700 or 800. And in fact, we should have sold them over 1,000 this last year, but we had a short crop for the first time in the 15 or 18 years we've been growing giant pumpkins. So it's a one-shot deal, and they go all over the Northwest.
How come the pumpkins didn't do so well this year? Just an example of things not doing well, or was there something you could put your finger on?
Part of the gambling that we farmers do, you know, we're the world's best gamblers, and you work with the weather. And if anybody has been aware of this last season, most crops were 10 days to 2 weeks late. The up and down weather we had in the spring was cool enough that everything was delayed. And my regular pumpkins were okay. The squash was great, but for some reason they did not set on. Normally they will set pumpkins on, and then after a while we'll start breaking some off. And in fact, they're still setting pumpkins on in October when we're harvesting pumpkins. But for this year, most of the plants put on one pumpkin, maybe two, and that was it. And it was really strange because we go through and turn our pumpkins, and we went through twice and that was it, and there wasn't any more to turn. And we usually go through 3 to 4 times. So it was a weather-related situation, and so we got half a crop.
Another thing you have to do, sticking with this same example, for a customer like Fred Meyer, I know you have to load the pumpkins with your forklift, because they're so big, into this pallet that we all see sitting outside the front door of Fred Meyer. It's got the wooden pallet and then the big cardboard box. You have to load these in. They do come out to the field and pick up with their truck, but this is an added expense for you, including labor, isn't it?
Yeah, I've tried to analyze the giant pumpkin crop a number of years ago, and we handle those pumpkins 7 times because we roll them onto a pallet in the field, and 2 to 4, depending on the size of the pumpkin, on one pallet, take them and unload them onto a trailer, bring the trailer in and roll them off the trailer and across the scales. We weigh every single one of them and then back onto another pallet and set them out by size around in our farmyard here. And then when it's time to sell them, we roll them back on a pallet and take them over to the pallet that the bin is on and roll them back onto the bin, and then they're out. But, you know, when you're getting anywhere from $10 to $20 or $25 for a pumpkin at a time, as opposed to a acorn squash that maybe you're getting 50 cents for, and you handle that two or three times, you know, it still works out economically. So that's another business decision you have to make.
It is a lot of work, though. I'd like to talk about labor. Do you employ your own workers, or how do you get workers when you need a whole bunch of them? How does that all work?
We have a crew of five that works full-time through the summer, and fortunately we have two different labor contractors. We've used one for a couple of years, and now another one we've used for a couple of years that has people available for us in the fall when we start harvesting potatoes and onions. Is the biggest labor increase in the fall, and then of course winter squash gets on top of lettuce and broccoli and cabbage and cauliflower that we're harvesting all the time, and then we add those others on to that in the fall, so we're able to get additional help. One day this last fall, I looked around the field and I counted, and I realized that I had 14 people working one day, but that was only a couple days. But often during September and October, we're running 7 or 8 people right along just to get the fall harvest in. So whatever you do, you've got to look at the labor cost. And of course, you base that on how things are going normally. Sometimes if we've gotten behind on our spray and you have a real insect problem with cauliflower or something else, and you've got to spend a lot of time trying to clean it up, or you throw out half of it and so on. I mean, there's been days we spent as much, you know, harvesting the crop and getting it packed almost as we got out of it. And so you say, okay, you relook at that and say, that's not the way to go. But those were all typical situations. But if you try to grow a crop and you look at the labor into it, and maybe if you're just doing it yourself and you're a one-man show and you've got 2 acres and you're doing a real intensive operation and you look at it and you're making $1 an hour, you know, you have to kind of say, you know, is it worthwhile to do this? So I've looked at the crops that I can grow and keep the labor costs down and still have a profit on it. But you do run into situations where weather or insects or something else has gotten to you. And, you know, like, even though now sometimes we've got onions out there in a cooler that we pack up all during the winter, and potatoes, and sometimes we've gotten into a bin that hasn't been real good. Well, so the labor cost has gone up. I still think we're making money at it, but you just have to say, okay, it's there. You've got the cost into it. At least run the labor cost out and get something out of it and get it out to market. I've tried to find niches. Like right now, we just picked 50 cases of Savoy cabbage out there. Well, there's only a couple of people that even tried to do it in the wintertime. So it's given us winter income, and I just try to find notches where somebody isn't working and see if I can fill that. So,
Dave, I know you're a churchgoer. Does your Christian faith inform your decision-making on maybe when you went organic and decided not to put poisons on food, or just in any other way?
Well, I think our Christian faith affects us in probably several areas. And I guess initially it wasn't, I never thought about it as much as far as going organic, although we gradually changed our lifestyle and realized that was a more natural way to go. I mean, I think organic fits in with God's creation. I mean, God made creation. We're trying to mimic the natural way that the earth works. I mean, it also affects ethics and how you operate, and you want to be fair and honest with somebody. I mean, we always stick at least an extra pound in a, you know, 30, 40, 50 pound box of produce. I mean, I don't want somebody to be short. I've thought about that, and I think I heard one business consultant or somebody knowledgeable make a comment, well, okay, if you're putting that extra in, you're just giving that away. Well, produce is a perishable product. It's not like, you know, maybe if we were selling salt or something, it wasn't going to deteriorate. You could go right down and put an ounce extra and be okay, but it's going to deteriorate in corn. You know, 48 years, what fits in a case. We always put 50 years in there. There's going to be one or two bad years in there. As you know, Bruce, you've picked corn out here. But anyway, so we just want to be fair and honest with people and make sure that what we do is right and proper. I mean, it's a frustration if somebody gets something that's not good In fact, we've had problems the last 2 weeks now with some of these greens that we've sold. Right after the freeze, they were okay, but they've been gradually, some of them deteriorating. The Italian kale went first, and then some of the others were starting to get some brown spots. The green kale was good for a couple of 3 weeks, and now we're starting getting some yellow on it. And I mean, that's horrid when, you know, OGC sends me a picture. Hey, oops, here's what's happened to your crop once we got it in the warehouse. And so that bothers me. I want to pack a good product, and so that's what we always try to do, and to be fair and honest with people in the way we do business.
Is there anything else that we should be covering? Anything you want folks to know?
Well, those of you in the metropolitan area, I appreciate your business. But I guess the support for organics is probably the important thing, is that there's a lot of debate among some quarters about whether it's worth it to pay a little extra money for organic and so on, too. But farming is fun. Like I say, I have a psychology and sociology degree, and I was probably of the five kids in our family the least likely one to farm, but here I've been doing it. And I think the Lord led us into that just gradually, and I just enjoy raising produce. My wife enjoys cooking it, but I just enjoy growing it.
The least likely in your family. Okay, next generation. You look healthy now. I know how old you are, but you look good and healthy for your age. What happens after you stop farming? What happens to this farm?
Well, you know, that's a good question, because one of our sons is an engineer down in Phoenix, Arizona, and our other son is in produce, but with Fred Meyer, but he's not a farmer either one. So I do have a nephew in California that has done some farming and would be the only person that I know in our family that could, if it worked out. That's a good question, and I've thought about that. When we moved here 5 or 6 years ago, I felt I still had 20 years good in me, and so that's a real issue.
It's an issue nationwide. I think the average age of farmers in this country is late 50s.
Upper 50s, yeah, upper 50s, right. So so I'm bringing the average up.
Dave Brown, I want to thank you, and we just want to mention Farmer Brown's wife, Nancy, who plays an important role here too, and also typical of farm families, she has a day job. It is food related, but she's got to do that too, or maybe she just wants to.
Yeah, I grow the stuff, but Nancy is a wonderful cook, and she loves it. So if anybody needs recipes or questions, you know, I always refer them to her.
If folks want to get a recipe from Nancy, or for more information, how can people contact Mustard Seed Farm?
Yeah, just go in and plug in Mustard Seed Farms on the internet, and on that has all our contact information, and we have a community garden person that maintains that website right now, although I think we're going to improve it this year, and there's been some recipes on there, but they could give us a call at 503-633-7333 is our farm number. And we have a few individuals like yourself, Bruce, that do come out and buy stuff, although we don't have U-picks. Other than in October, we do sell winter squash and pumpkins and giant pumpkins and gourds and related things during October, so we're open there.
David Brown of Mustard Seed Farm, thank you for joining us on KBOO.
You're welcome. It was fun.